D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Mit Sibylle Salewski. Wir können uns heutzutage kaum mehr retten vor Daten. Unsere Computer produzieren mehr und mehr davon. Zu bewältigen scheint diese Masse nicht mehr zu sein. Und dann wächst sie auch noch ständig. Allein die Daten, die online sind, nehmen jedes Jahr um schätzungsweise 50% zu. Werden wir dadurch schlauer? Nun, nicht unbedingt. Daten allein sind natürlich noch lange kein Wissen. Nur wenn sie zugänglich sind, das heißt, wenn wir sie aufbewahren und ordnen, dann können wir sie auch studieren, mit ihnen forschen und dann vielleicht wirklich etwas aus ihnen lernen. Wie wir das tun sollen, das ist die Frage, um die es im April auf einem Symposium zum Management großer Datenmengen gegangen ist, das in der Berlin-Brandenburgischen Akademie der Wissenschaften stattgefunden hat. Hier bei uns im D-Radio Wissen Hörsaal senden wir heute drei kurze Vorträge von dieser Tagung, die vom Zusammenschluss der Europäischen Wissenschaftsakademien, kurz ALEA genannt, organisiert worden ist. Als erstes erzählt der Archäologe und Direktor der britischen Digital Preservation Coalition, William Kilbride, was wir tun können, um Daten erfolgreich über lange Zeiträume aufzubewahren. Kilbrides Vortrag hat den Titel »The Challenges and Opportunities of Digital Preservation«. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
What I want to do in the next 20 minutes is just to give you a short overview, really, of some of the issues and challenges associated with long-term access to data. And I suppose I could summarize my presentation in one slide. Perhaps Sandra would let me finish my presentation after this first slide by simply saying three things you need to know about this question of long-term access. And it's fairly straightforward. This question of long-term access won't go away. This is a growing problem. And it's not a problem that will fix itself. This is a problem that requires some level of intervention. So what I hope to do in the next 10-15 minutes or so is show you some of the interventions required, some of the opportunities that accrue, and really provide a basis for conversation. There's a great deal of research to summarize in this presentation. So let me start where digital preservation presentations always start. They typically make bleak reading. I am by background an archaeologist. Perhaps Dr. Stancic might recognize some of this research. In the late 90s, we asked academics in the United Kingdom who were archaeologists, what they were doing with the research data that they excavated out of the ground. Remember, archaeology is a systematic risk to the historic environment. There's nothing more that archaeologists enjoy than systematically dismantling it. And consequently, the records we produce are, very important. And yet, in the late 90s, we asked our colleagues what they were doing with the data produced, and not surprisingly, there's little infrastructure and little effectively being done to protect the archaeological record. Very pleased, therefore, I was with a little quote right at the end of the report, which says that the archaeological record is in more danger in digital form than it ever was when in the ground. This is, I suppose, a typical place to start a digital preservation talk. We can do this several times over. Here's a more recent example. In the UK, a major funding body funding digitization asked us to ask those institutions what was happening to the data that they had funded at public expense for digitization. Some were able to give very straightforward answers, some were unable really to give any precise answer as to what would happen at the end of the digitization project. A further example from the public sector, looking at the answers to parliamentary questions, so questions posed to ministers in parliament. And of all the websites quoted in parliamentary answers between 1997 and 2006, 40% of the links had now broken. And bear in mind, these are not a random selection of websites. These are websites quoted in parliamentary answers. This is how we keep, I suppose, government to account. This is a game that we could go on playing for a while, I suppose. So let's try a little experiment, if I can be so bold. Can I do a show of hands? Would that be appropriate? Show of hands of anyone in the room who has ever inadvertently lost a file that they were working on. I certainly have. And it's, you know, it's a story we can tell on a corporate level, but also at a personal level. So what should we do about this problem, which we recognise and which is widely shared? So I'm going to give you very briefly four classic responses, and then we'll talk about some of the challenges. So the classic response, the most used response, is a migration response, whereby we take a data set, we migrate it through subsequent versions of the file format wrappers. So a migration approach to preservation, which might be, I suppose, described as intervening at a data level to manage the data. A second response, quite widely discussed, but not much used in actual fact, an emulation response, which might be described as intervening at a software or operating system level, in order that we can retain access to the information, we retain access to the software, and by retaining access to the software, we need all sorts of plugs and tools to make sure that data or that software remains readable. There are also groups doing a hardware preservation approach. This is a tricky thing to do, because in order to preserve hardware, you need to preserve also the components, and you need therefore to be able to find additional spare parts. And finding spare parts for computers requires having a spare fabrication plant, and that becomes really problematic, or can be. But nonetheless, there are contexts where that still makes sense. And finally, it's fair to say that there are still emerging answers to this question. And quite a few institutions in Europe have looked at this problem and noted that it is itself a research problem. So in some sense, the answer to this question might yet be in the room and might yet come out of the discussions that we have today. So we should be alive to the reality that this is itself a research question, and the research community is therefore extremely well placed to contribute to this wider social question. Six challenges then, and I'm going to run through. These are very high level, as is necessary at this point in the discussion. But let's just talk through six high level issues and how these have been approached by the preservation community. And we start with a kind of fundamental problem. And the fundamental problem is that use of digital technologies depends upon a configuration of software and hardware and people, and software and hardware and people change. So what we need to do is to understand that configuration in some way and understand how that configuration has come about and how it could be, in some sense, reconstituted. And that therefore makes it a metadata question. It makes it a question of how we represent that configuration in such a way that it can be made sense of in the future. And there has been significant amount of research on how one captures that sort of metadata, and there are standards about capturing that metadata which sit alongside some of the more classic approaches to managing metadata for scientific research purposes. Secondly, let's realise that technology continues to change. And moreover, that change is not a bug. Change is actually a welcome part of the IT industry. But this creates the conditions for obsolescence. So what we need to do is to plan accordingly. And we have to recognise that current plans may need to be updated. In fact, they certainly will need to be updated as software and technology continue to emerge. And therefore, in this context, we need planning tools, we need systems which can deal with that ongoing change in technology. And in a fundamental sense, any institution that wants to get involved in long-term preservation will have to, in time, become a learning institution, because it will have to be constantly learning and relearning about the developments in technology. Storage media fail. Storage media have relatively short lifespans and are themselves subject to obsolescence. So storage strategies need to be developed which allow for refreshment, allow for material to be moved easily from one platform to another. Can I say it's often confused between storage and preservation? It's certainly the case at a hardware institution or in a meeting of engineers. The idea of storage is often completely misunderstood as being the solution to preservation. But there's much more to it than that. But fundamentally, we do need storage solutions. We can't live without them. And there are multiple solutions in this space too. The most quoted axiom in digital preservation, I suppose, is the lots of copies keeps stuff safe phrase from the LOCKS group in Stanford University. And how we achieve that has a variety of different technologies available. Preservation systems are themselves subject to obsolescence. This is, I suppose, a warning to those who would come and sell solutions off the shelf and allow you, encourage you to buy a single one-time and for all solution. The reality is the systems are themselves subject to the same obsolescence they're trying to address. Consequently, we need systems which are component-based and which are modular in such a way that small components can be plugged in and plugged out as required, and that those parts of the system can be tested accordingly. And we're going to hear later, I guess, from Dr. Dorn, we'll hear more about the standards around, for example, the trusted digital repository. But there are standards in this space, and it's worth keeping track of the standards in this space, not least because there's a real risk in this growing community of fragmentation of those standards. And what we actually need to do is to pick up that best practice rather than reinventing best practice, especially if we can show that best practice being inscribed within standards. Digital resources are intolerant of gaps, so we can't put things on a shelf and expect to come back in 50 years' time and find that they're still there. In reality, we've lots of examples of where that's been presumed, but where that's not been possible to do. So we need to think about ongoing management of resources. And that lends itself to risk management. And there are different approaches to that long-term management. We can think about life cycle approaches. And this is where I think the funders have had a significant impact by, for example, mandating certain best practice at an early stage in project development. One creates the conditions where that long-term management becomes possible and realistic. But there are many other styles of approaches about thinking about long-term preservation or ongoing activity through time. And finally, thinking on challenges, resources can be corrupted or tampered without trace. And that means this world of digital preservation actually from time to time skirts close to the territory really now occupied by cybersecurity and by those fighting cybercrime. But it seems to me that some of the tools and technologies from the preservation community actually have things to offer to that wider economic set of challenges and vice versa. How do we understand fixity? How do we understand authenticity of data? There are a variety of tools in this domain, and research continues as to how one, for example, develops authenticity evidence records and so forth. So those are, I suppose, the four classic approaches and then six broad challenges, just intended to be provoking some discussion or getting some material together. What I want to say now is to take us back to why we do preservation and connect us back to some of the big policy drivers which we started today's presentations with. And it's an important message, I think, to take home, but it's a subtle message that needs carefully unpacked, that why we do preservation isn't because of data loss. Let me explain that in such a way that it can be understood. It's a risky thing, I realise, for someone who works for Digital Preservation Coalition to say out loud. But actually, there's something more subtle going on here that we need to be aware of. So what is the problem? Well, my observation would be fairly straightforward. Let's restate the issue of long-term access. And it seems to me, and everything we've heard so far tells us, that data has some value. It creates opportunities, it creates things that we can do in the real world. We can use this data to, you know, help us with scientific research. We can use this for all sorts of social and economic purposes. And it has, the data therefore has value embedded within the opportunities that it creates. But access depends on this configuration of software and hardware and people, and technology and software and hardware and people change. Therefore, the technology can create the barriers to reuse and exploitation of our data. And therefore, managing data in the long term protects and also creates and helps to transmit those opportunities from one generation to the next. My observation then, I suppose, is that we don't do digital preservation because of some desire to protect the data. We're doing it out of some desire to protect the opportunities that we see within that data. And we do it in the public sector, I suppose, for a bunch of reasons which are down to, I suppose, regulation or are down to policy requirements. Digital preservation, fundamentally, when you push back on the reasons as why we do it, it's about healthier and wealthier and smarter and greener and better connected communities and people and economies. And that's why it's worth investing in. That's why we want to take steps to protect this data, because in so doing, we protect those opportunities. And it's true also for the private sector, although the drivers may be different. Issues, for example, around regulatory compliance, around legal compliance, around legal protection. Here's a little fact for us for discussion. In the US in 2011, patent suit litigation, that is to say Microsoft suing Samsung, suing Google, suing Apple, all over each other's patents. Patent litigation in the US in 2011 reached $200 billion. That's 2% of GDP. This is a colossal problem. And the best way to protect yourself against that type of litigation is by robust records management and preservation and proving that you have title to the innovations you're behind. So, let me summarise what I'm trying to say then. Digital preservation isn't just about data or access or risk management. It's actually about people and opportunity. And when we talk about preservation, let's start there. Thank you very much.
Das war der Direktor der britischen Digital Preservation Coalition über erfolgsversprechende Strategien, um digitale Daten langfristig aufzubewahren.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Im Anschluss an William Kilbride hat sich der französische Linguist Laurent Romary einem anderen Aspekt der digitalen Datenflut gewidmet. Sein Vortrag hat den Titel Scholarly Work and Open Access. Darin geht Laurent Romary der Frage nach, wie Wissenschaftler und Gelehrte am besten und einfachsten Zugang zu den Forschungsergebnissen und Veröffentlichungen ihrer Kollegen bekommen können.
I'm going to speak about short-term access and indeed what is hot topic for many of us, which is open access to scholarly works at large. My main point is that we need to be very innovative to provide maximal access to scientific information, because basically scientific information is at the center of any kind of scholarly work. As soon as the scientist starts exploring new territories, he needs to know what the others have done, what kind of experiments have done, what kind of data they've been generating. They need also to, while making discoveries, to be able to disseminate their results. They need to communicate to others, and as we heard, also to the wide public at times. Most of the time, this dissemination goes through a kind of short haul, which is that of peer reviewing as we know it now. Finally, we should not forget that science, in its beauty, is based on some kind of less nice work, preparing grants, preparing reports about assessment, and actually basically making the research teams work. To this purpose, the scientists need again to manipulate scientific information, to gather evidence that they've done a good work before and that they will be able to do some good work afterwards. So scientific information, now taken from the point of view of an institution, me as representative of INRIA, for instance, in France, is about providing the researcher with the means to do this job, basically. Providing access to publication, traditionally through subscriptions, giving the means to record, disseminate his or her activity. We know about journals. And also allowing him to manage is information. So when we speak about open access, it may be at the end of the day the researcher's decision to disseminate some results to a colleague, to a community, or to a wider community, the public, when he wants that. And it covers more than publications as we know them. We know about laboratory notes. They may be essential to be able to reproduce an experiment. In the human sciences, as we will hear, there's the notion of primary source, which has to be made widely known so that people can compare the kind of analysis we make on them. And finally, all those databases in whatever kind of formats, not always based on standards, which have to be retrieved, understood, and further used. There are a few politically correct challenges there. Of course, we all know about the journal crisis and the high cost of traditional scholarly publishing. We need to deal with it. We need to accommodate with the new technologies popping in. A lot of the things we do are born digital in many of the domains, also in the humanities, and we do not rely systematically on paper activities. Finally, it's important to get a comprehensive view on the researcher's production. It's not just writing papers. It's a whole process dealing with an initial idea down to the dissemination of all the results that this idea has led to at the end of the day. Going back to the, I would say, traditional publication field, when we speak about a publication, it covers a whole range of activities from the point of view of the researcher, from the point of view of the institution, but also from the point of view of third parties like publishers intervening in there. You need to write your paper, you need to identify yourself as the owner, for instance, to fight against plagiarism of the corresponding paper. You need to be certified by the peers, and you need to disseminate. And finally, you need to make sure that what you're doing will be available in the long term. When we speak about open access, it has to do with dissemination. How do we just open the windows and let the thing go? I'll start with the theoretical point of view on open access and then give a kind of French touch on that by somehow presenting the wide range of French policies we have in this respect. The theory came from here, the Berlin Declaration, where we have a lot of keywords there. We speak about free, irrevocable, worldwide right of access to and a license to copy, use, distribute, transmit, and display the work publicly and to make and distribute derivative works in any digital medium for any responsible purpose. It's basically doing anything with the works that have been produced by our science at large. That's very nice. It's wide open. We would like to apply, and some of us sign it immediately. But when it boils down to the current situation, the current landscape in open access, you're basically either green or gold. So for those of you who do not know this terminology, we speak of green open access when we say, well, the author himself or herself provides access to his or her scholarly papers. From the point of view of the institution, it means putting together a repository infrastructure so that this is made feasible. And we speak of a gold open access when we say the publishing locus, for instance, the journal, will make the corresponding paper freely available to the wide community at the time of publication, for instance. This is gold open access. The current implementation, for instance, from the commercial publishing environment is to say, well, let's have the author pay for its publication. So you pay to make sure that your paper will be freely available online. There are some issues there, of course. It's strongly anchored on the traditional journal system, whereas we know that the situation involves. There are many ways, as we shall see, to publish results. We are not that close to the Berlin principles. A lot of the keywords, the nice keywords we've seen, are now being reduced. How far can we actually access and reuse under this condition? What are the licensing schemes that come with those deposits? There's nothing about data when we speak about green or gold open access. It's about journal. How do we make a global picture where data fits in? So basically, are there other colors or other shades of green and gold? This we could see perhaps by looking at the current French policy. As some of you may know, it's nearly impossible to speak about the French policy on open access without mentioning this HAL. Nothing to do with a famous movie. It's Hyper Archive en Ligne. It's a national publication repository which started in 2001, initially intended to be a mirror to archive, and which had had over the years a quick expansion to all disciplines, and also which has been taken up by most of the institutions, research and higher education institutions in France. So now it's 220,000 texts full text documents in there, and around 3,000 papers every month. The point about the HAL publication repository is that it is somehow double-sided. From the point of view of the researcher, it provides a direct channel of dissemination for his papers. Many of my colleagues, myself, are just putting drafts online to make sure that the colleagues can react and give feedback. And at the end of the day, when a publication has been accepted, it can also be there as a dissemination channel for my favorite version, I would say. It's also, from the point of view of an institution, a memory of the research results, because in there we worked over the years to make sure of the metadata quality, to make sure that the researcher appears with his affiliations. And in France, let me tell you that the affiliation schemes can be quite complex. It's also a way to allow the researchers, the teams, or the institutions to provide accurate reports on what they're doing. Some institutions, some laboratories are using HAL as a reporting tool. And basically, because you may ask yourselves, and the peer review in there, somehow we don't care, it comes as a complement to the peer review system. It's really about dissemination. So HAL has been so famous over the years that it has been a major stone in the national policy about open access, where in January 2013, where we organized a major event around open access in France, our Ministre de l'Enseignement Supérieur et de la Recherche, Geneviève Yoraszko, said, "L'information scientifique est un bien commun qui doit être disponible pour tous." You don't know French necessarily. Scientific information is a public good that must be available to all. In this respect, we decided to put together an open access plan in coherence with Horizon 2020, combining GRID open access as a priority, deposit in publication archives, GOLD open access to contemplate new ways of putting together journal infrastructure, and other forms of open access, as we shall see. This is organized in France by the major consortium of all research institutions and higher education institutions, which is called the Bibliothèque Scientifique Numérique, which covers all aspects of scientific information in France, which allows us to actually discuss the issues and move forward as quickly as we can. At a lower level, I would say, in April, on the 2nd of April, we actually signed, we being 25 national organizations in France, a memorandum of understanding whereby we take HAL as our central platform for disseminating publication in France. Finally, let me mention the specific policy of INRIA. So some of us, some as institutions, decided to go even beyond. So for instance, INRIA published in January 2013 an open access policy which corresponds to a deposit mandate. That is, only the publications in HAL will be taken into account at the end of the year for reporting and for assessment. We also have a what I call a cautious gold strategy, that is, we want to consider the benefits of an author pay model, but we want to make sure that it remains within our budget and that this is done at the conditions we express as scientists. Finally, which is really the main issue in defining our future policy in open access, is to know whether there are some other publication models, other ways of disseminating information, somehow to go beyond the green and gold divide. If you go to the humanities now, the young scholars are not, and maybe the not-so-young scholars actually blog their results. That is, as they go through the process of making discoveries, on working on sources, and identifying the new concepts, they create blogs on such a platform, hypothèse.org, which is not any kind of blog, but as a matter of fact, a scholarly blog which has an editorial committee in the background. Let me mention that something like Hypothèse, which is a French platform, now goes DE. It has 47 scholarly blogs in German, in the German language, with the support of the Max Weber Stiftung and the Institut Historique Allemand. I can mention also, turning to Peter Dorn, the Narcis environment, which goes in the direction and putting together publications and data in the same environment. So when you publish something on Narcis, you can also put data set in combination. Finally, let me mention something important, new business models. I'm referring here to the Open Edition platform. So this is another initiative coming from France, an initiative supported by three universities, the CNRS and the EHESS, whereby the idea is to make neither the author nor the reader pays in such a system, but to offer a so-called freemium scheme. That is, you can get the HTML freely online. You don't have to pay. No one has to pay. And then the libraries, which want additional services, cataloging services, to have the EPUB available, for instance, to actually read that on your iPad, can pay an extra fee and actually offer that, for instance, to the students or the scholars in the university. Finally, even more experimental, for those of you who have seen this news in Nature in January, we want to create epi-journals. Basically, you take a publication repository infrastructure, you let a user, a researcher, upload one of his paper, and then click on a button which is making the paper being sent to an editorial committee. If the editorial committee agrees with the quality of the paper, you get stamped in a way. And it's like a mini journal being organized on top of a publication repository infrastructure. So we go step by step to a situation where we've got the possibility to have new visions in a way. We can imagine, and it's not science fiction, you already have virtual astronomers which do not see a telescope in their life, whereby a scholar plays with an environment of information. He identifies it himself or herself, that comes with all his affiliations automatically. He's got research folders where he can gather notes, data, and so on, and then it decides on which openness it will associate to these research folders. Basically, it says, well, I've gathered enough evidence concerning a new discovery, I would like to have two or three colleagues observe that, basically. Or this is set, I'm sending that, like in the EpiScience project, to an editorial committee. Or at the end, it says, well, I'm just happy with my results, push and make it widely open at the end of the day. In this context, certification comes in many ways. Of course, you've got the traditional editorial committee, but basically you can also have the comments from the community at large, which is basically what we want as scientists at the end of the day. So it's quite a change that we've got in front of us. Looks a little bit like science fiction, but basically what we know is that we need to experiment. There's no one single scheme to implement open access. Thank you.
Das war der französische Linguist Laurent Romary über Open Access für wissenschaftliche Daten und Veröffentlichungen. Romary hat diesen Vortrag auf der Tagung Management of Large Data Corpora am 29. April 2013 in Berlin gehalten. Diese Tagung ist von der Europäischen Föderation der Wissenschaftsakademien, ALEA, organisiert worden.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
In unserem dritten und letzten Vortrag heute hier im D-Radio Wissen Hörsaal geht es um die Frage, welche digitalen wissenschaftlichen Archive vertrauenswürdig sind und wie es in Zukunft möglich sein könnte, wissenschaftliche Standards für die digitale Veröffentlichung von Daten sicherzustellen. Trusted Digital Archives heißt der Titel des Vortrags des Niederländers Peter Doorn. Doorn ist Direktor der niederländischen Data Archiving and Network Services, kurz DANS.
I'm going to talk about trust in digital archives or digital repositories. I will use the words loosely. So DANS is an institute of the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences and of the Dutch Funding Organization for Research, NWO. Our mission is to promote permanent access to digital research information. And although we were created in 2005 in the current organizational setup, our first predecessor dates back to 1964, when the Steinmetz Foundation for the Social Sciences was set up. And the oldest data that we hold in our archive go back to the late 1950s, early 1960s. Our main activities and services are to encourage researchers to archive and reuse data. Our largest digital collections are in archaeology, social sciences, and history, but we also give services to other disciplines, and we are gradually moving into other domains as well. We provide access through the Narcissus NL system to thousands of scientific data sets, electronic publications, and other research information in our country. We do data projects in collaboration with research communities and partner organizations, both within the Netherlands and internationally. We provide advice, training, and support. I will come back to the data seal of approval. We have a persistent identifier infrastructure that we maintain. And finally, we do some research and development into archiving of and access to digital information. Well, this morning I was quite surprised when I saw the Dutch national newspaper, the Volkskrant. It's of today, because it carried on its front page the data fraud case by Diederik Stapel, a social psychologist who appears to have entirely made up his data and has published over 50 publications that were based on such non-existent data. Also, many of the people he worked with and even his PhD students often used the non-existent data of Stapel. It's for the first time that he was interviewed, but the international press has paid a lot of attention to data fraud cases in the past few years, and I must say that our country has been plagued by a number of cases. There was the case of Diederik Stapel, which originally came out in September 2011. In November, there was the case of Don Poldermans in cardiovascular medicine, although it is not entirely clear whether that was true data fraud or whether he was more, let us say, not very accurate in the dealing with his data. Well, his inaccuracy was so big that he lost all belief. I mean, people did not believe him anymore. In June 2012, Dirk Smeesters, another social psychologist, was unmasked. And more recently, in October of last year, a cultural anthropologist appears to have made up a lot of his information that he used in his studies. A committee was set up by the Academy, not really because of these fraud cases. That was already an earlier plan to study data practices in the humanities, in the social sciences, and in science. The Schuit Committee did some bit less than 100 interviews with researchers across the board and found that there was a lot of variation in data practices, both across disciplines but also within disciplines. There was also some pattern that could be discerned. For instance, that data management in small-scale research was usually much more risky than in big science. And that is logical, that peer pressure appears to be a very important control mechanism. If more people are working together, it is much less easy to be fraudulent. There is more checks and balances. But the risky period, and that holds true again across the board, is that checks and balances seem to be missing, especially in the phase after a research proposal has been granted and before the publication. As I said, there are considerable differences among scientific disciplines, across scientific domains, with respect to data management and data sharing. There is no time to go into the details here, but there are several studies, both within our country but also internationally, from a European project, the so-called PARS Insight project, that provide a lot of information on this subject. What is clear is, and that is the same in both studies, is that many researchers appear to be managing their own data and preserving that on their own computers, on their own hard disks. The Schuit Committee came up with a number of recommendations, and the Dutch Academy endorses those. Hans Klevers, the president of the KNAW, wrote in his foreword to the Schuit report that maximum access to data promotes the preeminently scientific approach whereby researchers check one another's findings and build critically on one another's work. The Academy supports the free movement of data and scientific results. Taking into account variations across and within scientific disciplines, the free availability of data should be the default. This is not to say that it should always be the case. A motto that seems to work quite well is open if possible, protected if needed. Furthermore, we do not need additional rules or codes of conduct, but should focus on revitalizing existing rules and making these better known. Also, in the education of future scientists, of students, that is. And finally, the examination of data management practices should become an integral part of official research evaluations. That seems to be the right place to look into how data has been treated in research. Now over to the main dish of my presentation. Talking about trust, what do we mean with that? And what do we rely on if we say that we rely on a trusted digital repository? Well, we had a famous, or we still have it, famous kind of suite, Rang, which used as its catchphrase, Rang is alleen Rang als er Rang op staat, meaning something that only if Rang is written on it, you can be sure that it is the real thing. But is that also the case in a trusted digital repository? Or is that true of those repositories of certain physical objects, such as that we have in our wallets, money, I mean, banks? The experience of the last few years are that even if they are supposed to be trusted, again, something bad can happen to them and can happen to our money. It is important to know that things are not always what they say they are, and things do not always state what they are. It is not so simple as that. But trust in research data is, I think, a very important thing. We are talking about the quality of research here, essentially. So trust is at the very heart of the creating, the storing, and the sharing of data. And that means that there is responsibility there for the data creators, the data users, the data repositories, archives, and the funders are maybe a bit out of place there, but, well, in a way they are very important too, because they have the possibility to put certain requirements of those categories of actors. And if we talk about data quality, we talk about, I think, the subjects that is not my opinion, but is quite usually taken, the aspects that are there, but something that I don't want to go into now. And what is trust built on? Well, I don't think that it is so very different in digital archives than in other things, even in human relationships. Even you might think secretly of the relationship to a very special person that you have. Perhaps the first thing, if we're talking about trust, is to dedicate yourself. And in terms of a digital archive, that would be to have a mission statement that is clear, that clearly states that the archive wants to do. The second is to do what you promise. And in terms of a digital archive, that is to have a good reputation, a reputation of sincerity, of competence, not only for a very short time, but for a long time. And the third would be to be transparent, to have your behavior, your activities checked by peer review or by a process of formal certification. And I very much like personally the cartoon on the right-hand bottom that says, in principle, we're happy with the trust idea as long as it's properly monitored and regulated. Now, I'm not a fetishist in rules and regulations, but I think a certain degree of rules and regulations should be good in this area. The UK Data Archive puts on its website the first idea of pledging, of making a mission statement, and it says any organization which provides access to data over a long period of time should be fully trusted only with a public statement describing the practices they follow and the provenance of data they provide. Standards of trust are critical. And we see that a number of the research infrastructures in the humanities and the social sciences also hold this certification and trust idea very important. For instance, Clarin Eric says that Clarin centers need to have a proper and clearly specified repository system and participate in a quality assessment procedure as proposed by the Data Seal of Approval, or, it's a long abbreviation, REC approaches. REC will come back in a moment. But do we really need certification, official certification of digital archives? And to be honest, there is some discussion going on there. Not everybody is convinced of that. There are some people who say no, and in this case I will also be the devil's advocate. Some people say that trustworthiness or certification, it should actually read, of digital repositories is an illusion. It's too complicated to measure. It's impossible to maintain over time. It is too informal, too expensive, and too time-consuming. The positive arguments for certification are that there are already a number of levels of certification which are fairly clearly written down and fairly balanced and with good procedures to do an audit. And those different levels can also be used for different needs. Then again, to the no side, objective and consistent auditing is an illusion, some people say. For instance, Helen Thibault, who said literally, when this was discussed on a conference that was in particular about digital preservation, if auditing becomes a career, what will happen to objectivity? And she and others also believe that it is impossible to guarantee consistency around the globe. Well, against this, one could say that auditing is a career already in many other areas, including areas that have to do with quality control. And next, perhaps the needs in China or in South Africa are a bit different from those in Germany, or the approach in Italy may be a bit different from that in Russia. But some variation according to local requirements, why should that not be permitted? I already said in the previous slide that there is a number of different levels of standardization of quality of certification of digital repositories. There are essentially those three, the Data Seal of Approval, the DIN, the Deutsche Industrie Norm, the German, and the International Standards Organization Norm. And they function more or less as the bronze, silver, and gold, where the ISO certification is the highest one, the most encompassing. Basic certification is granted to repositories which obtain the Data Seal of Approval. Extended certification is granted to basic certification repositories, which in addition perform a structured, externally reviewed, and publicly available self-audit based on either the ISO or the DIN. And formal certification is then when a full external audit and certification based on ISO and DIN is carried out. The three certification methods, so to speak, also work together in a European context. Perhaps a few words on the Data Seal of Approval that originated at my own institute. It was our initiative, although it is now governed by an international board. It is fairly simple. It gives 16 guidelines. It is based on a self-assessment, which is then inspected by peer review. It is highly transparent. What an archive does with respect to digital preservation is publicly and openly available, and so far 14 organizations have this seal of approval. It is important to know, by the way, that the data seal does not only put criteria for digital repositories, but also for the data producers and for the data users, because it's like a chain. The data producers are responsible for the quality of the research data, and the users are responsible for the correct use of the data, incorporating, for instance, also referring to who collected the data in a correct way. The DIN norm is based on the criterion catalog Vertrouwenswürdige Digitale Langzeitarchive, Nestor, instigated by the Deutsche Nationalbibliothek, and contains some 34 criteria. And the ISO 16363 is based on the Open Archival Information System, and here it is maybe a bit too technical for you. And there is also the Trusted Repository Audit and Certification track. You may forget that, but it is maybe interesting to know that it contains over 100 metrics that you have to comply with. In various places, there is ongoing work on trust. For instance, in the so-called APARSON project. APARSON stands for Alliance for Permanent Access to the Records of Science, Network of Excellence. Then there is those three certification methods that are already working together in the European Framework for Audit and Certification and that are now seeking collaboration with the ICSU World Data System, which has perhaps what could be considered as a fourth method of certification, although they call it accreditation. And then in the recently founded Research Data Alliance, there is also active a group on certification. Because the journals, in my view, also play an important role. The quality control of scientific output concentrates on publications, and we have a well-known system to do that quality control. It may have some flaws, but still the system of peer review is essentially a good thing. And even it could be improved or modified in the digital world, still we need specialists looking at the work of other specialists to get some value judgment. But very few journals so far have a data availability policy, although the number is increasing, be it in the one domain faster than in the other. And the idea of such a data availability policy is that when a paper is submitted for peer-reviewed publication, data access for the reviewers of that paper is required. And at a second stage, when the paper is published, the readers should be able to access the data. And usually then the data is to be deposited in such a trusted repository, although by no means it is already completely clear which repositories would be available for what data,